Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show. Hey, all you avid listeners out there, this is Dr. John, and if you enjoy what you're hearing on these joint podcasts with me and my fiancée, Jory Rose, please know that we are offering a week-long retreat in Costa Rica in April of 2023 at one of the top resorts in the country where the body workers are next level, and you will learn from myself and Jory how to be in better relationship to yourself, to your loved one, and to everyone else. This is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Please feel free to check out the podcast notes for more links, details, and info. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Hey, everybody, this is Dr. John back with another episode of the Evolved Caveman Podcast. Thanks for joining us. And today it is my extreme pleasure to have with me my good friend, Soren Kaplan. And I'm going to read his bio because it gets pretty intense pretty fast. So Soren has a PhD. He's an award-winning author, a former corporate exec, founder of three Silicon Valley startups, a columnist for Inc. magazine, and an affiliate at the Center for Effective Organizations at USC, but we'll forgive him that last one. He is an international keynote speaker and has led professional development programs for thousands of executives around the world, including Disney, NBC, Universal, Visa, PayPal, Kimberly-Clark, Medtronic, and a bunch of others, Red Bull, Hershey's. His work has appeared in Harvard Business Review, Psychology Today, Forbes, Fast Company, CNBC, and many others. Soren, thanks for being here. How are you?
John, pleasure to be here. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming aboard. And the reason we're gathering today is because of your new book, Experiential Intelligence, Harness the Power of Experience for Business and for Personal and Business Breakthroughs. And Soren didn't think that IQ and EQ were enough, so we wanted to add another Q to the equation. So let's start out with the question of what the hell is experiential intelligence?
Well, that's exactly right. IQ and EQ are not enough to help you navigate today's disruptive world. If I asked you, what percentage of your intellectual intelligence, your IQ, is responsible for your success personally and professionally? There's no research-based answer to that, but I think most people would say not a lot. And so, we learned about emotional intelligence, in the 1990s with Dan Goldman's book by the same title. And I think that that's been important to understand, our emotions and empathize with others. And it's a success factor in leadership and business. But what I've seen over the last 25 years, looking at myself and my own process, but also working, around the world globally with many different leaders is that one's experience actually creates a level of intelligence that helps us navigate the world and solve, address opportunities and figure out how to overcome challenges. And so the essence of experiential intelligence is that the combination of our life's experiences give us mindsets, abilities, and know-how that fall outside of IQ and EQ that are responsible for success. And we don't talk about our experiences in this way, nor have the language yet to really, package it up and make sense of it and leverage it as a thing so that we can use our experiential intelligence to achieve our goals. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book.
So a couple of things. For those listening, let me just say that Soren is one of the most intelligent, evolved individuals that I've been exposed to. And he's done his work for years. Like, he's done a lot of work on himself. And so just for those of you listening, I just wanted to say that because he's quite an exceptional man. So just wanted to share that with you. Well, but also, as far as experiential intelligence goes, it strikes me as you were talking, how does this map onto or overlap with something like street smarts?
It maps very well. And so
that was kind of my thought.
Yeah, you picked up on that. And let me bring this to life with my own personal story because
please, it's a great story.
I bring, you know, I what I wanted to do with this book is, you know, it is grounded in research and it's grounded in kind of a lot of, you know, theory, so to speak, but it's also really a personal book for me. I reveal kind of how this stuff works by my own personal example. And so, and I get really vulnerable with it. You know, a lot of men in today's society, our society in today's world, struggle with vulnerability. And I sort of want to role model what I think all, you know, all individuals, male and, you know, leaders and, you know, can benefit from. And so here's my story. I grew up a product of the very late 1960s. Parents were, they were pretty smart. They had gone to Harvard and were studying world religions and philosophy. They dropped out of school. We lived on kind of a little ashram with a guy named Richard Alpert, who was also has also been known as Ram Dass. So my parents were seekers. We found our way to California. And by the time I was 15 years old, we had moved 16 times. My father was working multiple jobs, rarely home. We had moved to California because my parents wanted to be part of what they were calling a Sufi community. It was a spiritual community in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area in Walnut Creek. And when I was three, though, my mother developed a mental illness. And it turned out to be schizophrenia. But we didn't know it at the time. So I grew up with a father who was rarely home and present and had other priorities. My mother had a mental illness, and we were bouncing around from one home to the next for the vast majority of my younger years. So I had to live with a lot of, you could call it trauma today. That's kind of a hot topic, I guess. But the essence of it was my life was uncertain. I didn't know kind of who was going to be taking care of me and when. I had to live with a lot of ambiguity. I had to make decisions around what to do. Sometimes I wouldn't get picked up at places and have to figure out how to walk home at a pretty young age. And so what that gave to me were two things. It gave me some challenges I had to work through and work on myself around healing. But two, I've looked back on those things as part of my healing. The flip side of that is growth, meaning the same things that traumatized me at a young age gave me unique gifts. I can be in very uncertain environments and find patterns in data that, you know, like in changing organizational cultures. I can live with a lot of uncertainty and make decisions with very little data and pivot new directions, which I've done a few startups. I have, you know, been able to work with the things that I gain through my life experience, my street smarts, and apply them to my professional life. That's not to say sometimes my street smarts outsmarted me because my coping mechanisms as a young kid didn't work as I got older and had relationships and went into business. And so I had to kind of unwind those street smarts and get smarter about what was driving me inside and what was, you know, kind of the, you know, what was making me tick. So, you know, kind of to wrap it all up, we all have street smarts. We gain it from the moment we're born. Sometimes they benefit us, sometimes they don't. The value of experiential intelligence is having a framework, mindsets, abilities, and your know-how to understand your street smarts. And you can then understand yourself better and then apply that to achieving your goals or to building your teams or changing your organizational culture, however you want to decide to apply that.
Oh, thank you for sharing the story, or at least part of it. I've always found that story to be pretty compelling. And I think you're right. Like, vulnerability is a big part of it, part of this for us men in our evolution, and just learning how to share these stories, which might involve some shame or embarrassment for us. I'm not saying yours does, but I think that's typically what stops us. And as far as the experiential intelligence street smarts go, I mean, I remember being in high school years ago and knowing, like, I could point to people and say, she has great book smarts, not so good on the street smarts. He's really street smart, not super book smart. And that was kind of the way that we divvied it up. And so how do you begin to break down this experiential intelligence? You said mindsets, beliefs.
So the way I've packaged it up, and I also want to say the concept of experiential intelligence was initially introduced by a guy named Robert Sternberg. He was president of the American Psychological Association. So it's one of those terms that was introduced from the field of psychology, but hasn't really taken hold in the field of psychology, nor in business or society for whatever reason. But now is the ripe time for it, because I think after COVID and with all of what's going on today, we need to recognize that experiences actually give us some form of intelligence. Now, how do we understand that? Well, the way I've taken the initial concept is I've looked at your experiences shape how you think, your mindsets. And your mindsets are your attitudes and beliefs about yourself, other people in the world. You also oftentimes can develop skills, knowledge and skills that really is your know-how. That's kind of like the base level. Like you do stuff over and over and you kind of learn how to kind of navigate some very tactical things. And then you have in the middle your abilities. And those are usually higher order things like pattern recognition or living with uncertainty and things like that, that kind of bridge how you think with what you know how to do. And so those three things are the elements of experiential intelligence. It's oftentimes, I look at it kind of as a pyramid. The base level is your know-how, and it's usually easier to understand your own know-how. The second level is your abilities, and sometimes it's harder to extrapolate, like, here's what my real kind of core abilities are. And then it's harder to see your mindsets. So it's kind of that pyramid of level 1, 2, and 3 that's really your experiential intelligences. And as you grow more aware of those things and you develop them, that kind of increases your experiential intelligence.
Okay, so let's operationalize this, or let's put it into concrete terms so that I can better understand it. So the base level know-how, let's say I'm 16, I have a car and I get a flat tire, and then I figure out from that experience how to change a tire. Is that?
Yeah. So you know how to.
Does that fit?
It fits. So I'll give you, let's just blow that analogy up or out. So you look at a car as transport. You could look at it as transportation in terms of mindsets. Car is transportation. It's also a way to have freedom. It's also a way to go kind of exploring.
It's also a place to make out in.
It could be a place to make out in too. And
I'm just saying.
Many cars are, yeah.
So, at 16,
Your mindset tells you kind of how you view this vehicle. And then, there's other things around mindsets, around safety, around drinking and driving. Like, and those things, you can have a mindset around that too. And you can have mindsets that say it's okay. You can have mindsets that say I need to be cautious. You have mindsets around your seatbelt, your ability. So, changing a tire, filling up with gas, maybe fixing the car. Those are very kind of nuts and bolts knowledge and skills. Yeah. The abilities kind of in between that would be, okay, I can anticipate, drive defensively, or I can kind of anticipate challenges up, in front of the road because I'm reading into curves. It's kind of that next level of being able to kind of internalize how to drive a car.
So they can be, any of these, I imagine, could be positive or negative if you were to apply a label to it. For instance, I could also, like, I've met some people in the past that claim to be good drunk drivers, which to me is kind of the epitome of idiocy, but okay. But that seems to me to be an ability that you could infer that you have because you've driven drunk many times and never had a problem.
So that's where you start to get into some of the probably prior experiences you've had outside of driving cars that have instilled mindsets around how you view safety, how you view risk, And how you view perhaps caring for other people or the ability to kind of protect others from yourself. And so, all of our life experiences can have an opportunity to shape us. And so, you kind of talked about, like, we're bringing this to life with the example of driving a car. Some of my own examples I use in the book, and they don't always have to be negative. So, for example, I was with my grandfather, and I was back east. He was actually a fashion designer. And we were in a store, and he pointed out some, discount flannel shirts, no name brand. And he was kind of joking. He's like, if the name brand said this, people would pay five times as much for the same shirt. And he was kind of laughing. He's like, yeah, people are just, they're kind of being fooled by these name brands. And it really, I was probably 7 or 8 years old, and it really stuck with me that what I learned from that and what I internalized was that, people have different motivations. There are, there's this, we didn't use the word like consumer behavior, but there's, a lot of kind of deeper psychological things driving people around how they value money, how they look at value. And I came away from that with, not abilities and not, kind of knowledge and skills, maybe a little knowledge, but more of a mindset that I was curious to learn about how the world works and why people would behave in seemingly kind of a, not a rational way, but just kind of in a way that was counter to how I was operating. But that then led me to be curious about psychology and consumer behavior. And I got into innovation, and I've done a lot of market research, and it led to skills and abilities. So there's usually threads that kind of move through life where those connection points can happen and kind of lead from one thing to the next.
Well, and part of this is, as far as mindsets go, connects me to Jared Clifton's work at UPenn with the Primal World Beliefs, which I think is in your book as well. And I think you and I have talked about in the past, because Jared wouldn't go this far, but his beliefs are all about the world at large. And then you and I have talked about, well, what are our beliefs at large about people in general or about self? And I can see where experiences have a huge impact on the creation of those beliefs. For instance, you're dating a girl, she kind of breaks up with you and goes and sleeps around with all your friends. That's going to lead to a more negative belief about women in general, perhaps. Like, it's easy for us, I think, to overgeneralize from one experience. Or if you get betrayed several times by people, it can impact how much or what percentage of people you believe are trustworthy in general.
That's true too. And the other flip side of your example would be, it could lead to some self-limiting beliefs about how attractive you are yourself because your girlfriend left you. And, there's a lot that can happen. The primal world beliefs are in the book because part of what I've got a whole bunch of tools and templates that kind of help make a lot of this kind of amorphous stuff very concrete. being able to I have this tool called the beliefs mapper. Well, based on your experiences, what are the messages you received from those experiences? And then what are the beliefs you took on? Well, if you took on beliefs that aren't serving you well, you oftentimes want to flip those around if you can. But one of the challenges is knowing, what do you replace a belief with? And how do you even replace a belief? Well, the primal world beliefs are a wonderful tool because you have a list of, I don't know how many there are, like 20-something.
26.
Yeah, 26. And you can see the negative view of the world. And then the flip side's right there to say, wait, if I didn't see the world as dangerous, I could see the world as safe. And if it's safe, then I can feel free to go explore and take risks with how I, go out in the wilderness or whatever it is. And so those primal world beliefs are just a wonderful tool as a menu of options that then gives you the ability to kind of see yourself, figure out what you would prefer to have. And then the opportunity is to create new experiences for yourself that then start to instill a new way of being. And so that's, you know, there's a lot kind of wrapped up in that, but that's, you know, that's the primal world beliefs are a great tool for that.
Well, and one of the things that I thought was cool as hell about your book is the QR codes at the beginning of each chapter. And I was like, oh, that's a QR code. And I went with my camera and scanned it, and it takes you to the web where there's videos and tools. And I was like, oh, Soren, nice job.
Well, you know, there's a lot of kind of research and kind of theory grounding experiential intelligence, from psychology to education to neurology and trauma research. And when you look at, for me, I've done a lot of executive education and leadership development. It's the experiences that change people. So experiential learning is really the secret sauce in leadership development and organizational change and culture change. And so those experiences shift mindsets a lot of times. So one of the things I wanted to do is make this book as experiential as possible. And so I convinced my publisher to let me, essentially, you're right, I put a QR code at the top of every chapter that I recorded videos that you just, it links right out to the video and gives the backstory about the chapter in my own words so that it tees it up. And then within the chapter, there's a lot of times tools and templates that I refer to that are part of this toolkit that you can download and get when you get the book. So trying to make it interactive, trying to make it an experience essentially, and practical, so that you can use these templates for yourself or with your team and organization as well.
So how would you say that XQ, experiential intelligence, interacts with, or I guess interacts with IQ and EQ?
So I think they're all complementary. I'm not trying to say experiences are more important or, you know, more valuable. I think they all interact and they're all complementary, really. I just think that experiences as a form of intelligence is this third leg of the stool that's existed from the dawn of time in human beings. You talked about street smarts, but we just haven't talked about it like that. And we haven't connected it in to the broader dialogue of what leads to success personally and professionally. So the relationship, I think, is strongest as I see it with emotional intelligence. Meaning, if you're, well, some of the things that can impact you as you grow up can create, well, I call them impacts. They can be big impacts or little impacts, and they can be negative or positive. And those impacts can create what I call visceral memories. So if you know, you think back to some positive experience, you can actually experience positive feelings. You can also think back to perhaps some painful experiences, and those same feelings may be at play, or, you know, the painful experiences may come up. That's all based in kind of trauma research. There's a great book called The Body Keeps the Score that, mm-hmm. you know, kind of highlights how you actually get wired from your experiences. It mostly focuses on trauma and PTSD, but a lot of little experiences can wire you too over time. And so the point there is that emotional intelligence is about being in touch with your emotions, about being in touch with those visceral responses that you have that might, you know, you have some thoughts, they connect to your feelings, and then they connect to your behavior. And you might have these automatic, autopilot, knee-jerk responses to things. Emotional intelligence will help you deal with those. But experiential intelligence will also help you deal with those, from understanding what are those things that even should be on my radar to work on, if it's kind of the things you need to heal from or address, that might not be big traumas. It might be little things that, like, you know, fear of judgment. Like, if you have a fear of judgment that isn't due to some big trauma, but then you can't take feedback in your team because you have fear of judgment and it closes you off, that's something to look at. So what I've tried to do is essentially provide a way in which to understand the impact, the experiences that most impacted you, so that you can then kind of get in touch with those and process them. And if you need to process them in terms of kind of psychologically getting more grounded and emotionally getting more grounded when you deal with them, that's, you know, you can do that through meditation and EMDR is a great tool. I've used it. Kind of rewires your neurology so that you don't get reactive around certain things that might have been triggers in the past. Various things you can do. But the other point is that you can also look at your experiences that were positive, that give you joy. And if, you know, this is also grounded in positive psychology. How do you look at the things that happened and the strengths they gave to you that you can leverage? And that's from my, you know, my first example was all about that. And we all have those experiences, whether they're hard or, you know, joyous, that gave us those strengths. And the question is, how do you decipher them? Greater emotional intelligence will help you decipher them more easily. But if you work on your experiential intelligence, you can also develop your emotional intelligence at the same time. It's a feedback loop.
Yeah, I've got my mind kind of goes 600 different ways when you're talking. One of the things it makes me think about is resiliency and recovering, or I guess reframing, like what would be a painful, hard, or difficult experience with that question of something like, you know, what can I learn from this? So that it turns down the volume on the pain, but also allows you to withdraw some lesson that supports you out of a difficult experience.
I think that that's right on. And what you're sort of also getting to is that the concept of experiential intelligence is much broader than applying to business or leadership. We're all just people and we all have experiences from the moment we're born. And so, you know, what resiliency is important in terms of psychology, education, parenting, to understand kind of how do we look at the experiences that are happening every day and try to build in the ability to understand them in terms of the options that we have and then the strengths that they give us, or create experiences and craft and design experiences for our families or in education that instill certain mindsets, abilities, and skills that are needed for the future. So I resonate with the concept of resilience. I also think it's important not to try to kind of diminish that traumas are, you know, can be very painful. They can, you know, require a lot of healing. And some people may or may not ever want to or be able to see like the flip side, which in some research is called post-traumatic growth, where you have a trauma and you come out the other side and it's changed your life. You know, you see the world differently, you have a new mindset, you have a new purpose in life. And, you know, post-traumatic growth is, you know, it's being written up in HBR even as a thing that can happen. I don't want to suggest that we should all look at traumas in a positive light, but I do think that there are opportunities to look at, and I use myself as the example, look at the things that happened to us and decipher them from what they instilled in us that we can leverage to move forward.
Yeah, I don't think that trauma would ever be looked at in an all positive light, but it doesn't have to be looked at in an all negative light either. I think there can be a mixed bag there. And I think that, you know, I think maybe the purpose of life is to change, grow, and evolve. If you're stagnant, I mean, think of water, right? If it's a stagnant pond, it's going to grow moss and, you know, it's going to get nasty and dirty, muckish. Whereas if it's a flowing creek, it's going to stay clean and healthier as an ecosystem. And I think we're quite similar to that. And so I get it. I get your point that some people might get stuck in trauma. And I don't look at that as a personal weakness. I just think that we also want to strive to find a way to incorporate it into our overall being, make sense of it, and use it as a platform for growth. I think both are possible.
I
think you've done it in most of the areas of life.
Thank you. I've tried to illustrate that principle and what you just said in the book. I think that the opportunity for all of us is to recognize that, like, usually usually there's some stuff that were struggles in our lives. Like, not everybody has a perfect life, and there's really no such thing as that. And so, you know, we have a combination and a collection of unique experiences, all of us. Some of them are hard and some of them are, you know, fun, and we enjoy them. They all are instilling things in our being in some way, shape, or form, whether we're conscious of it. Sometimes we are, sometimes we're not. The opportunity is to be more conscious of what's driving us. And experiential intelligence is an opportunity as an idea to use a framework and a structure to look at those street smarts that we developed and see what's serving us and see what's not. And then whatever's serving us, let's lean into it and leverage it and do more of it based on what we care about in life. And if we want to look at the stuff that might not be serving us, those are things to start addressing as well, that if we address, usually it reveals some of the strengths that we've been missing. And then we can leverage the things that kind of get revealed to us. I know that that's, you know, happened in my life.
Yeah, I agree. And how do you think experiential intelligence dovetails or interacts with a concept like self-awareness, a la Tasha Urich, where, you know, there's two parts to it. There's internal self-awareness and there's external self-awareness. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's a huge deficit of self-awareness in our country and in our world right now.
I think that I've heard people that I know have, and I've been close to, say that they had perfect childhoods. And that comment, for example, is, my view is, when one says that, it's just that they don't want to be vulnerable with others because it's too painful, or they don't, there's so much pain there that they have a hard time even acknowledging that there were some significant issues that they experienced. So, and without, of course, naming names, some of the examples, when I heard that, I knew that there was abuse in the home with the person who was, you know, who's saying that. Mm-hmm. And so those self-awareness, I think, is a really important asset as human beings. The more self-aware we are, you know, the more tuned in we are to our emotions and to what's driving us and the thoughts that we have, and how those thoughts can lead to certain feelings, then lead to certain behavior. If we are more aware of what's driving us, or that we even have, you know, certain thoughts coming into our head, we can then decide more consciously to let the behavior flow from the feelings that those thoughts might drive. And so there's a lot about, you know, that we could talk about around meditation and mindfulness and so forth. That is that principle. I believe experiential intelligence is connected to that from the standpoint that, and the reason why I gave that first example, the more self-aware we are, the more we're able to look at our experience without being triggered by it, or without being closed off to it because it's painful, so that we can see it for what it is. And what it is whatever it is that happened, we had certain things go on for us around our feelings during that moment, our thoughts during that moment, and it may have carried forward and either served us well or not. And if we're more self-aware, we can look at that and then be more conscious about, do I want those things to carry forward? Do I want to, you know, have a fear of judgment still and not take feedback? Or do I want to be able to just take feedback without judgment and decide whether I want the feedback or not to grow? So absolutely, there's a connection point there for sure.
One of the things that keeps coming to mind, and I keep trying to suppress it, but it keeps coming back, is this idea of internal family systems. It seems to, I don't know, intertwine with this a little bit. Or maybe it's a tool that can be used to help with some of the difficulty that they have in experiential experiences, EQ, XQ experiences. I'm not sure my wording there, but you know, it's been something I've been playing around with lately. And just this idea that we don't have one mind. We have a core self with perhaps hundreds of parts. And those parts were parts in ourselves that got frozen in time back when we were 2, 4, 6 years of age, when something difficult or traumatic happened to us and we came up with the best rule that we could to deal with it. And that part is still playing that role at whatever age we are now, using the same defense mechanism, which probably isn't as helpful now that we're adults, for example.
Yeah, that's your street smarts outsmarting you right there, is what you described. Mm-hmm. And you know, going back to your question or comment though about family systems, I mean, where do our experiences start? Our experiences start with our families typically, or with our caregivers, however, whatever family structure we might be in. And so that's the starting point of experience. And so much of what I think people end up needing to go to therapy about or work on or gets in the way of business success is stemming from things that happened in our family systems. And that we're unresolved around, or that we, like you said, kind of get stuck because of some traumatic thing. But those, you know, it doesn't have to be a big event. If I look at my own experience, my father was not around very much, and he was in, you know, really focused on his spiritual pursuits and working with his teacher, spiritual teacher, and he wouldn't really want to spend time with me, and he'd be explicit about it. He said, this is more important to me. And so his honesty, it was appreciated on the one hand, but as a, you know, young teenager, over a series of, you know, years, I had this belief instilled that I wasn't worthy of attention. I wasn't worthy of appreciation or focus. And that, you know, on the one hand, it was really painful and I had to work through a lot of stuff around that. On the other, like, I wanted to get appreciation and worthiness somewhere else. So what did I do? I went to some really good schools and I, you know, you read my bio, I've done a lot of stuff. And by kind of typical objective measures, I'm pretty successful. But that workaholism and the, you know, kind of striving for external validation was compensating for many years for this thing that was kind of gnawing away at me that I wasn't aware of, that I wasn't feeling worthy, and I was looking for it other places. So now that I got aware of it, I can have more balance. I don't have to do all this. I don't have to fly around the world anymore doing all this stuff. I can, you know, kind of be more present with myself, figure out like how to spend more time with my two daughters and my wife and, you know, kind of come back together. My father's still around, and appreciate what I do have with him now. And so, you know, that self-awareness that I had to develop, I developed because of, you know, a lot of struggles that my overcompensating for it, you know, was creating for me. And so, you know, that, you know, the things that happen in those family systems oftentimes are shaping us and driving us without us even knowing it. So, you know, that's where it all kind of ties together.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up, because you read my mind. I was going to ask about self-worth. And I think you're absolutely right in terms of it doesn't have to be something big that happens to us. It just has to be something, I would argue, that makes us feel.
Yeah.
Because that seems to be the driver of a lot of this, right? That, you know, your feelings get hurt, and that can be pretty minor or over something pretty minor, but your feelings still get hurt. And so I appreciate you sharing that with us. And I also take your idea to heart of the internal versus external validation. I think that's such a big theme for people in general, specifically for men, because I think it's one of the hallmarks of evolving into a mature man is when you get that movement from needing so much external validation from others about you're a good guy, you're a successful salesperson, you're good at this, you're smart, whatever, to internal validation, where you can practice frequently patting yourself on the back for simple things like just behaving in keeping with your values.
I think that's so spot on. If we can give ourselves internal validation, it opens up a new world of options for us, because we're not doing things for other people, or we're not doing things to compensate for things that happened in the past that left gaps. And so I think what you just said is just really important and useful. So, you know, so it's a hard thing to do, but it's also something very worthwhile. And being in touch with, I mean, you kind of go back to what are those experiences that you most, that are most poignant in your life that had some emotion connected to it. If you just start listing off, kind of brainstorming that list, you will find things in there that maybe you haven't explored. And then you can look at what are the messages that I received from other people or from that experience, kind of objectively. Like when I look at it, what was I being told? So, you know, I've got a lot of these little things with my dad. I was told I'm not worthy. Well, you know, I didn't.
Or that's a message that you inferred.
That's what I meant. Like, I'm trying to kind of object, make it kind of more like, not that it's actually said, but that I'm quote unquote being told it because my filter is saying that to me, so to speak. So, yeah. Thank you for the clarification. And so if I internalize that message, what then did that lead to in terms of my beliefs? I call it the beliefs mapper, because like, how do you know what your mindsets are and your beliefs? Well, look at your experiences, look at the messages you received, and then what beliefs did that instill in you? Sometimes the messages and the beliefs are the same. Sometimes they can be different.
Well, and one of the things I like about the mindset research is that pick a mindset, whatever mindset you have, you know, all people are assholes, or, you know, I'm a pessimist, whatever it is. Once you become aware of some of these, they're pretty easy to change. In fact, some can be changed just with the awareness and deciding to make the change.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, sometimes they can be harder. If you think all people are assholes and you go and you go shopping and you're treating everybody like assholes because they're assholes, they usually will treat you like an asshole. Yeah. And then everybody's so an asshole.
Self-reinforcing.
I've had the same kind of thing. Another example that I came up with is in my book. I went, my father took me car shopping when I was like 17. I was trying to buy a used car, and it was a terrible experience. Meaning the car salesman, it was kind of typical used car salesman, trying to take advantage of us, kind of was a little bait and switch kind of stuff going on. My father, I could see, was getting super kind of wound up and uptight, and there was a lot of tension. The whole interaction was like 15, 20 minutes max. And we actually did end up buying this car. But it was such an unpleasant experience. It's not a traumatic experience. It was just really like unpleasant, but it was very emotional for me. And then even though like in the room, I probably didn't even say anything. I was just sitting there. Well, that experience has made it so that when I'm interacting with salespeople, I get like a little bit wound up. And I'm sure that I'm not pleasant. And, you know, I'm sort of aware of it. And I'm trying to like, you know, these salespeople are probably just trying to help me out. And I'm like all uptight and like, what are they trying to sell me? So that's like the negative side. But this on the positive side, like that also reinforced, like, I want to understand people's motivations. Like, I want to see, like, is there an underlying business model behind what they're doing? Is there, and it, it's given me the ability to kind of it gave me the motivation, the mindset to want to develop like my skills around facilitating rooms and reading the room when I'm managing groups and understanding motivations and, you know, doing innovation design thinking research and empathizing with people to understand unmet needs and really what's going on, even if they're not saying it. So, you know, there's oftentimes these little moments, if you look at your experiences, that you can say, I had this poignant experience, I had some emotion around it. Let's decipher it. and let's figure out what are my mindsets today that are connected to that, or skills and abilities that I've developed.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. And for those listening, you can see why my conversations with Soren often have me on top of my game, if possible, because they're very challenging intellectually. And one other question I wanted to ask you just in wrapping up. So how are you putting this experiential intelligence into play into the business world? I know it's not exclusively for the business world, but what does that look like and how are you doing that?
Well, thanks for asking. So my view is experiential intelligence, we all have it, so it can apply to business or not. But, you know, I've spent 25, 30 years running. I ran the internal strategy consulting group at Hewlett-Packard in Silicon Valley. I've done a few startups. I've had a consulting firm doing leadership development and innovation consulting work. And so what I am continuing to do is help leaders understand their own experiential intelligence in service of developing teams with a diverse kind of portfolio of experiences. And then how do you change organizational cultures to really leverage experiential intelligence? Because, you know, everyone is bringing stuff to the party that's outside of their job descriptions and their resumes. So if we as teams and organizations can appreciate the fact that there's certain things that are kind of outside that formal resume, how do we leverage everyone's strengths? And how do we take people who might be retiring? We have a huge kind of age wave of retirees. And how do we tap into the not just the job descriptions and kind of the skill sets they had, but how they thought and how they knew how to do things kind of in a tacit knowledge kind of way? That's mindset, that's ability. And so, you know, kind of continuing to work with organizations to kind of build out organizational cultures, leveraging best practices from people and building, you know, growing leadership in the spirit of kind of developing teams and organizational culture.
Yeah. And as you were talking, it made me think that we're missing a huge untapped potential with that baby boomer kind of aging, you know, 60 something workforce, because I hear over and over again that companies won't hire them. They want to go back to work, and they're this huge untapped goldmine of experiential intelligence potentially.
Completely. So, you know, there's strategies you can use to, like, you know, kind of capture knowledge and capture abilities and codify kind of the assets of the older workers, so to speak, who might be retiring. But there's also things that you can do, like a lot of younger workers don't necessarily have college degrees in the same way that we've had college degrees. There's fewer men getting college degrees today. And there's actually a downward trend in the belief that a college degree is actually useful. And there's debate about whether a college degree will actually help you earn more money. So we're seeing a migration away from college degrees. So if you're not looking at college degrees, what are you looking at on resumes when you're trying to hire new talent? So you've got this kind of older population that's exiting, and you have a newer population where maybe you should be looking at or trying to create experiences and looking at the assets from those experiences as you bring them in. And maybe you can pair them together in some way through mentoring and through training and other things that is kind of, you know, growing both ends of that population at the same time, and like kind of leveraging all of what everybody has to offer. There's, you know, it's kind of untapped territory right now, and we haven't figured it out, but I think that's where the future's going.
Well, I want to say thanks for all the effort and work that you put into operationalizing this concept, because I can say without any doubt that the most valuable learning I've done in my life has been experiential.
So I can too. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. What didn't I ask you that I should have?
You know, the only thing that you didn't talk about is your own experience. And as you think about, you know, I oftentimes flip the microphone around when I'm doing these podcasts, because I think that to really understand experiential intelligence, it can be helpful to apply it to yourself. So, you know, maybe I'll do that to you right now and say, as you think about some of your most poignant experiences that really shaped you, let's say it's, you know, before you're 20 years old, what are, you know, what's one or two of those experiences, and what did you take away from that experience that has either, you know, let's put the positive spin on it. What did you take away that helped you think differently and that you probably are using today to be who you are and be successful, and that you believe you could probably leverage moving forward? What do you got for me?
One of the first thing that comes to mind was I crashed an ATV down in Mexico when I was 19 on spring break, and was not wearing a helmet, got a terrible concussion. Came home the next day, threw up at 3 a.m, drove myself to the ER. They took a CAT scan and said, yeah, you're bleeding on the brain. You've got a moderate concussion. And oh, by the way, how did you get here? And I said, I drove myself. And they're like, oh, you shouldn't have done that. And they're like, go home, have someone wake you up every 2 hours to make sure you're alive. And at that point, I was like, oh my God, I'm screwing with my future. My brain is my future. And I could have damaged it permanently.
Okay. So you then took away an appreciation for your mind and for growing your capacity of thought, as well as just kind of your presence in the world using your brain. And is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah. I can lose a finger. I can lose an arm. I can't lose my brain.
Yeah. So that appreciation that you have now for that, what did it lead you to go do that you might not have done otherwise?
No, I would say get a PhD in psychology. I would also say work to stay healthier on multiple levels in order to take care of my brain health.
And how are you going to use that moving forward into the future? What's that going to enable for you?
Greater influence.
Yep.
Greater reach.
So that's great.
I mean, like you, I use words to motivate and inspire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If I have no brain, no bueno.
So you've also developed abilities to very tactically run a podcast, very tactically create, you know, social media presence, and you have a great abilities to communicate. You got a great voice too, just so you know.
Like your thank you.
Voice is awesome. But you know, so if you look at that combination of things, that experience that you had, I'd call that post-traumatic growth right there. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was kind of I wouldn't call that a positive experience. I'd probably call it a trauma. And you took something away from it that has instilled a new way of thinking, a mindset, and led you to develop abilities and skills that you just articulated. And I kind of was kind of riffing on that with you. And now that you can leverage that to achieve the kind of goals and achieve your purpose that you're trying to achieve. And if you can do that with what you just talked about, there's probably a dozen other things that you could probably decipher as well. And the value also is helping other people decipher it for themselves. And that's the scalability of experiential intelligence, because I think we develop more of it ourselves, more of our own self-awareness when we help others decipher it for themselves. And it's like this kind of exponential possibility when we're helping others and helping ourselves at the same time.
When there's a philosopher, I think it was Jacques Derrida, that said something about the best way that we grow and evolve is through a radical shattering of one's framework. And I think of that as taking your glasses and throwing them on the ground and stepping on them. And then you got to get down on your knees and piece together those lenses. And naturally, you're going to have a new way of looking at the world. And that seems to me to be a way to encapsulate experiential intelligence also at some level.
Completely agree. I mean, you can use different words, a paradigm shift or a mindset shift. In my own experience, as I gained insight into myself and my experiential intelligence, I literally have become a different person, so to speak. I see the world differently, and I'm able to show up differently, and I have different priorities, and I have different ways of being And I have different ways I think of achieving my goals. And this book is an example of trying to scale the benefit of what I've experienced and give it to other people. And so that's, you know, that's kind of where I've landed. And I, you know, I appreciate your openness to kind of riffing a little bit on all these kind of wild ideas, and hopefully, you know, people find value out of them.
Yeah, absolutely. It was my pleasure. I mean, those conversations were fantastic. So where can people get a hold of you? Where can they get the book?
My website's my name, SorenKaplan.com, SorenKaplan. If you go to the website there, you can get the book from there. You can get it on Amazon or any Barnes & Noble or anywhere else. But if you go there, you can get a free, you know, first chapter. You just download it. If you get the book, there's a whole toolkit as well that includes lots of the tools and templates that we've been talking about that accompany the book and accompany the videos that that we also talked about that start out every chapter. So, you know, there's the, you know, my website, and then you can, you know, find stuff from there.
All right. Well, thanks again, and excellent job on the book. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. And if you liked or loved this episode, please feel free to rate, review, share with a good friend. If you didn't like it, you don't have to do a damn thing. Thanks so much. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.